From the home of the codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the June 2015 edition of the Bletchley Park podcast, The Road to Bletchley Park. This month's episode is so named because we're bringing you a first peek at a major new exhibition at Bletchley Park about codebreaking during World War I. The Road to Bletchley Park takes you back 100 years to the days before codebreaking was a joint effort, when there were two very separate departments working amid great secrecy, including from each other. The exhibition is open now and will be formally launched soon. Also coming up, we'll steep ourselves in vintage style at the 1940s boutique as this most glamorous of days out makes a welcome return next month. We'll go back to the first boutique day last year, when I met a mother and two daughters whose mother and grandmother had worked at Bletchley Park. They had a heartbreaking story to tell about the real cost of keeping the details of her work secret from her family. And we have a real treat all the way from Toronto as we join one woman's quest to find out more about her mother, a Canadian Wren who died when she was only 10. Anne Hereford worked in the naval section at Bletchley Park in the last year of the war. When she was being shipped home, she was briefly interviewed by a legendary war correspondent. That recording now means the world to her daughter May, who lives in Ottawa. We'll hear what happened when May tracked down a woman who worked with her mother at Bletchley Park. But first, back to where we started. Where it all started, in fact. The roots of Bletchley Park's codebreaking success in World War II can be clearly traced back to World War I, when several of the key figures of the Government Code and Cipher School were already engaged in the business of snooping into the enemy's communications. A major new exhibition tracing the roots of this codebreaking powerhouse back 100 years is now open and will be formally launched soon. The first people to see it were members of the Friends of Bletchley Park. Podcast producer Mark Cotton and I went along to see what they made of it.
Good evening. For those I've not met, I'm Ian Standall. I'm chief executive here at Bletchley Park, and it's my privilege and pleasure to welcome you here this evening to the Friends preview of our new exhibition, The Road to Bletchley Park. This exhibition has been 2 years in the making. All these things seem very simple, but actually take a lot of time and effort to take them from a concept to the exhibition you're going to see this evening. This has been a road of fundraising, research, development, getting together all bits and pieces, and finally the installation, which actually is the easy bit compared to all the others. So it's a two-year journey to get to where we are now. And this exhibition is a very important exhibition for us. It tells the story of really the birth of modern communications technology, or more importantly, how you exploit that to produce intelligence. So it talks about cable, wireless, and the people who started in the First World War in breaking into these communications means and producing war-winning intelligence. And very importantly, it talks about the people who are doing it. Because, as you'll see and hear, many of the people involved in the First World War went on to ply their trade here at Bletchley Park during the Second World War. So it is an important backstory to what we do here and sets the scene, hence the reason why it's called The Road to Bletchley Park. Of course, it's very important that it is open at this time as well, because we are, of course, in the centenary of the First World War. So it's only fitting that we do our own tribute to the First World War here at this time. And as we are running a commercial heritage attraction, hopefully that will encourage more people who perhaps have an interest in the First World War rather than the Second World War to come here and then explore the park further to find out more about the fantastic work that went on here during the Second World War. As a World War I buff myself and a battlefield guide, I'm also very excited about this exhibition because it's telling a story that nobody else seems to be telling at the moment. You can go to the Imperial War Museum in London and look at their fantastic new World War I gallery. And the bit about this particular aspect of the First World War is one panel. So it's great. We're taking that and expanding it out into a whole spur here, telling that story. So I think we're telling a unique exhibition. I should also point out that what you're seeing today is only part one. This is a two-part exhibition. The first part runs for 2 years, and then in 2017, we open up the second part. So do please come back when we have the second launch in a couple of years' time to see the second half of this exhibition. Now, of course, all these things don't happen without many people in the background. And I'm going to run through, and excuse me if I read off my list to make sure I don't miss anybody, some of the thanks that we owe for this exhibition coming into fruition. First of all, very importantly, the funders, BAE and Ultra Electronics, two firms with long lineages in the electronics industry, and both of whom can trace back their ancestry to people involved in this story in the First World War. So it's great for them to be able to sponsor this exhibition and create that link between what they do today and the First World War. And talking about funders, Claire Graysbrook, who drove the fundraising team and drove the process to bring that money in, which is very important. Event Communication, who work with us, they work with us on a number of other projects to deliver the exhibition and have taken these concepts and ideas and research and turned them into a very engaging and interesting exhibition. GCHQ, again, many of you will know that a relationship we have with GCHQ. In large part, we are there outside the Wire Museum, and they keep on turning up great little things for us to show in our exhibitions. You'll find some of the artefacts in there have come from GCHQ. Our in-house team, the curatorial staff who've worked right up to the wire today to make sure everything's in place, everything's working, and everything's on show. Dr. Sarah Ralph. Sarah has been involved in this programme intimately for the last year, doing all the research, putting together all the material to allow us to produce the exhibition that we have here.
Approaching the entrance to the World War I exhibition, which is called The Road to Bletchley Park, because that's what it takes you on, the road from code-breaking World War I to where we are here at Bletchley Park, focused on those 6 years of World War II. And with Sarah Ralph, our World War I research coordinator, who's the brain behind this exhibition, really.
We got to preview the exhibition to the friends, and it was really good to see people react to this story, because as we've been trying to explain throughout this exhibition, is that it's a story that isn't that well known. And obviously with World War I, you think obviously of sort of the horrific loss of life on the trenches, but there's also this secret war that was taking place back in London with the development of code breaking. And so quite a few of the personalities that started off in World War I then came to Bletchley Park in World War II. So it's really nice to see people learn about this sort of new story to do with code breaking, and obviously then the links to Bletchley Park.
So it's about the foundations that were laid in the way that code breaking was tackled and some of the personalities involved. And of course it's something that was inevitably personality driven, wasn't it?
That's been the great thing about sort of doing the research for this, is you get to learn about the people who started it, and obviously testing out ideas really to do with code breaking and learning new skills and new knowledge, because really this is sort of the first time on a large scale that code breaking is taking place and being used to gather signals intelligence. So there are some really key people that come from the universities, from naval education, that obviously make a big impact on the code breaking, and so it's been really nice to sort of read about their stories, and obviously we have some really nice photographs too of those individuals.
Well, it can seem quite a dry way of finding out about people to someone who's not a professional researcher like yourself. You know, photographs that are 100 years old and documents and records, but you've found life jumping off those pieces of paper, haven't you?
Well, it's sort of the way in which things get described, and particularly with a document that we found at the University of Aberdeen in the collections there associated with Malcolm Hay, who was the head of MI1B, who was the Army code-breaking section. This was a book that was given to Malcolm Hay on his retirement after the First World War. And it gave you sort of these really nice personal insights, the way it had been written, and obviously the affection that they had for Malcolm Hay, and also the work that they were doing. So this sort of allowed you to sort of learn a little bit more about their lives and how they experienced war within the offices, particularly, as I said, of MI1B.
So let's go inside. So we start off with an archway. Tell me about that.
Obviously, working with Event, who are the design team, we were really keen to sort of emphasise the fact that this isn't something that was happening at Bletchley Park. So we have the Admiralty arches being created here, so you immediately get the impression that you're definitely not in Bletchley Park. So we move in, and hopefully you can see on either side of this sort of lenticular effect of walking through Admiralty arches, and then you have the image of London.
So to describe a lenticular, as this isn't a visual medium podcasting, you've got a zigzag-shaped kind of vertical panel system, so there's about half a dozen vertical panels, and you're looking at them in one direction as you walk in. You see them sort of lined up one behind the other, and those images connect, so they're sort of sections of an image.
Yes.
So on the way in, you see one set of images, and on the way out, you see Bletchley Park.
Yes.
The AV is quite important in this exhibition, isn't it? Tell me about the introductory video.
This is obviously setting out in a sort of a very brief and visual way the work that was actually carried out during World War One, and how the two sections of code breaking in the Admiralty and with the Army were established, and also giving you a brief overview of the type of work that they were doing. The images that are being used, I think, sort of really highlight the work that they were doing. And so some of these come from the archives as well. So, we're really pleased with how this has turned out.
I think there's a real richness to these images. I really think it jumps off the screen in a way that perhaps you don't expect of photos so old, which are very, very two-dimensional. They're black and white. They're quite contained in a way, images like that, aren't they? But this gives them somehow, it's something very clever with the perspective they've done that gives them the depth and life.
Well, the idea behind this section also was to create sort of a theatrical effect. So you have this image being created around the screen that sort of looks a bit like a cinematographic
image. Oh, yes, the curtains. Yeah. And yeah.
This is obviously where we're trying to introduce the story of World War One code-breaking, but also introduce in this section the technologies that were so key to the code-breakers.
And we have a replica of a Marconi crystal receiver set. How important was this equipment?
We really wanted to emphasise the type of technology that was sort of at the hands.
It's less easy to do for this period, isn't it, than it is for World War Two, because obviously we have access to all GCHQ's existing surviving equipment. That's not the case with this, is it?
There are sort of few examples that still survive. So we've had a replica made of a Marconi crystal receiver set, but what we really wanted to show is that we often think about wireless and cable as being sort of relatively old technologies, but obviously at the time of World War One, these were actually relatively new. And so these were cutting edge. And so we really wanted to show this through the equipment that was being used, and then also show this through the graphics and the information about how the codebreakers were able to utilise this technology and draw on all this new scientific development to help them intercept coded messages, but then also use direction finding equipment to be able to sort of track the movement of German airships, U-boats, and obviously naval vessels as well. And all of this was obviously important to sort of halt any attacks that would happen on the British mainland, but also gain information to use for their advantage.
It's something we often say at Bletchley Park, that how much war is a driver of new technology, and you know, it really accelerates it, doesn't it? And that's obviously the case in that conflict as well. Let's walk through to the next section.
Hello! Welcome to MO5E. The room is not very big, and there are still two or three more to fit in. Where were you before being recruited to this department?
I was up at Cambridge doing European languages, enjoying rowing, rugby, beer, and playing mahjong.
Here. Let's hope you enjoy deciphering intercepted German wireless messages just as much. But first things first, we must get you a cup of tea.
Obviously, this is a two-part exhibition as well. So this first phase that we have that runs till 2017 is all about introducing the two organisations that developed at the start of the First World War. So we have MI1B, which is the Army code-breaking unit, and we also then have the Naval code-breaking unit, which is Room 40. So this particular area where we're standing in at the minute introduces MI1B, the Army code-breakers. In this one, we have a lot of photographs that have come to us from the collections of Malcolm Hay up at the University of Aberdeen. And these give you a really nice insight into the physical code breakers themselves. You get to actually see what they look like, where they actually worked, and sort of the type of things that they were working on. So this has been really interesting for me to be able to sort of see the people that you're reading about jump off of a photograph. We have selected pages as well that come from this retirement book. There's a lovely colour depiction of how they viewed themselves in terms of sort of ancient Egypt. And so this was drawn by one of the workers, and there was a story written about the work of MI1B based on sort of ancient Egypt.
And it just shows what kind of highly educated people these were, that their minds were not only Lewis Carroll, but cartoons in the context of ancient Egypt, and writing in code to each other, and poems at great length and with great skill.
I know, and obviously, as I said, for the array of languages that have been written in the book as well, it just shows you the sort of the diverse nature of the people that were coming together.
I'm starting to see why you got so excited about this book now, because there's so much rich material in it for you to learn.
This is to sort of give you an overview of some of the documents that were created as a result of the work of the code breakers themselves. This is an opportunity to see the code breaking books that were used by the World War One units, particularly Room 40, as they have a larger archive that remained after World War One compared to MI1B. So here we've got a copy of a code book called the AFB code book that was Birch's personal copy. And as you go through the code book, there's details that relate to the different types of U-boats in particular, and Birch is written next to each of those call signs when they were sunk, what happened to them. So again, you've got this really nice sort of
tiny writing.
Yeah, personal sort of way of looking at the war in relation to particular vessels that we have here.
Very unusual message. It doesn't seem to follow the standard patterns of naval terminology. Codes can be so damn tricky to break without a crypt. A practice code, sent by the operator, perhaps. A poem?
So now we come to Room 40, where Dilly Knox must have been working, because here we have a bath.
Yes.
Now, not a lot of people know that. That's perhaps not as common knowledge as we think it is.
As we're going through the research, we sort of came across little descriptions of how Dilly Knox chose the office in the Admiralty that had the only bath, because he often did his best work in the bath. So here we have a bath to sort of replicate that within Room 40. And there's also an audio that plays that is based off of an anecdote of him solving a particular code based on recognising that it links into a German poem.
A eureka moment, but with more methodical kind of brain work put into it leading up to his realisation. Yeah, that's brilliant. And tell me about the tubes.
And again, there's a sort of an element of discovery within the exhibition too.
These were pneumatic tubes.
Yeah. And here we've got some illustrations relating to Room 40 and a concert that they did at the end of the war that sort of celebrated the work that they'd completed, but all in the guise of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which is a theme that you'll see in sort of Room 40. Based off of this concert that they did at the end of the war, Birch wrote a parody really of the work that Room 40 did, and there were a number of caricatures that were drawn into this that sort of highlight particular characters that were working in Room 40 and how they were linked into characters from Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. It's been nice to sort of research this aspect of World War One, which is relatively unknown, and to sort of bring it to the public so they get to actually realise there was this secret war that was taking place, which perhaps code breaking is always now associated with World War Two, but actually it had its roots really in World War One.
I'm very impressed by the various bits and pieces that I've seen here. I know the basic plot, but seeing some of the actual evidence in photographs and copies of handwritten instructions is quite different from reading it at second hand, if you like, in history books.
It brings it all together, doesn't it, and brings it to life somewhat.
It certainly adds at least half a dimension to what I know already, so it's good news, good value.
It's good to know that someone who knows the story already finds it well told here. That's
encouraging. It works. Yes.
Excellent.
It also gives me some information that helps understand other things not related to the subject. So, for example, the cable network that the British maintained had a rather interesting use from the Dutch East Indies, from Java, during the great sugar beet boom just after the First World War, when a character who was rather too near the edge of the law to be sure which side of it he was on made a lot of money through early information about sugar beet prices and sugar movements by cable to European markets, not by putting them on the cable, which is direct, which was full of other things, but sending the messages first to Australia and then to South Africa and round the bottom end of Africa to Europe, and therefore getting ahead of his competition. They make it much more clear, that picture of the cable network.
There's always more to learn, isn't there, about any subject?
One of the nice things about this is that you never know when something unexpected turns up that teaches you something that fills a gap.
Yeah.
And this fills a gap not just in the First World War, but other things.
Well, I'm glad you've enjoyed it.
It's worth the trip.
Thank you.
One of Britain's first actions of the war was a master stroke of communications sabotage. On the night of the 4th of August 1914, five of Germany's six cables in the English Channel were cut. The sixth cable was redirected to be used by the British to intercept German communications. Britain had already recognised the importance of cable. It encircled the world with lines and ran them only across its own red territories and under the ocean. The all-red line was considered complete by 1911. Not only were UK cables protected from interference, many foreign powers were forced to use Britain's extensive network for their own messaging. Britain was in the ideal position to intercept friends and foes alike.
Yeah, it's very good, isn't it?
It's very good, yeah.
We've been here a few times, haven't we? We had a few visits. Very interesting. Yeah.
I love the entrance.
Yes, very cleverly
done. Quite
evocative.
It is very Whitehall. I like that. And as we go out, look, it's the road to Bletchley Park. So there's Bletchley Station. I think that's really clever.
Yeah. No, I mean, I must admit, I thought it was going to be a little bit dry, to be honest, you know, but it's not.
No, it's not.
No, it's
all
really
about
good.
The people, isn't it? That's great.
It is, yeah.
We did a very quick walk round, and now we're going to do a slower walk round and actually read more stuff.
That's right, that's right.
To just get an over-impression of what was here.
That's it.
Make sure you listen out for Dillian.
Okay.
Okay, right.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Knox? Mr. Knox, I know that you're in the bath, but do you need me to take down any codes that you've deciphered during the night?
Miss Rodham, I must speak with Dr. Willoughby at once.
I think it was an excellent exhibition. The introductory film was brilliant. I thought the effects in that was superb. I really love the period feel to the exhibition. The documentation that's been shown is wonderful. As well as being a Bletchley Parkophile, my interest has expanded into the American code breaking and the World War I code breaking as well. From what I know of the story, it's very accurate. And like I say, the introductory film, I think, hit the nail on the head. It's not overlong, so people aren't going to get bored and walk away. It tells the critical points during the war, the cable cutting, the Zimmerman telegram, and the visuals that accompany the story are stunning. I'm really amazed with it, and the rest of the exhibition as well. And I like the bathtub. It's a nice touch, because that's a story that's been told in many of the Bletchley books as well.
By the time the war ended, MI1B employed just under 90 people. Britain had become a world leader in the field of intelligence. In 1919, Alistair Denniston, a Room 40 linguist and codebreaker, headed a carefully selected group of Room 40 and MI1B employees, forming the new Government Code and Cipher School, which continued to ply its trade through the 1920s and 30s, before Denniston brought his team here to Bletchley Park at the advent of the Second World War.
It's nice for the first time to actually see the story of the First World War code-breaking told, so that we can discover the history prior to the Government Code and Cipher School and see the separate roles played by the Army intelligence and also the Naval intelligence, and how they came together to form the Government Code and Cipher School, and what happened at Bletchley Park during the Second World War. Stuff like Dilly's bath. But it's the personal history, isn't it? It's the personal way that they used to work and the techniques that they use. I hear these names, but you know that they started a bit earlier than that. They were here in the First World War. Got all different archives in here. You know, like Ian said, you can bring it all together, can't you? Which is really good.
I sat with Ian Standen, CEO of Bletchley Park, after yet another new exhibition opening. Bletchley Park is just growing from strength to strength, isn't it?
Indeed, and this particular exhibition is great to be able to launch it during the centenary of the First World War. It's an exhibition about code-breaking and intelligence production in the First World War, and provides us with an insight into how I suppose the SIGINT business really started. You know, the First World War sees the advent of radio and cable for military communications and indeed diplomatic communications, and then very quickly people breaking into those means of communication to provide intelligence.
World War I in reality was the first, some people describe it as modern war, because the First World War was the first war really to have such massive advances in technology, wasn't it? In the air, on the land, you know, simple things like the machine gun. But we see that in our side of the story as well, don't we?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the First World War brought together, so I suppose, the elements of modern warfare that started with the American Civil War and through the sort of back end of the 19th century. But the First World War probably saw the greatest technological advances, as you say, in the business that we look at Bletchley Park, in the SIGINT business, huge technological leaps during that war. And as a result, you know, this production of, you know, valuable intelligence from cable and radio, but also, very importantly,
it gave a lot of people a grounding in the business and understanding, which helped in the title of the exhibition. It's called The Road to Bletchley Park. Helped with the folks doing their work in the Second World War. As you'll see through the exhibition, a number of characters started plying their trade in the First World War. That's Dean Ox, Frank Birch, Alistair Denniston, to name but three, who all appear on the roster of Bletchley Park during the Second World War. And that's a very important strand that we pick up in the exhibition, that people strand, and try to understand not only their initial exposure to the business and development of it in the First World War, but also some of the humorous sides. You'd have seen the Alice and ID 25, this comedy book pantomime that was produced by the folks in Room 40 at the end of the war to just sort of, if you like, laugh at themselves at the end of the war, using the Alice in Wonderland story as a vehicle to sort of take the mick out of each other. On the other side, in the MI1B story, again, you'll see this replica of Major Hayes, leaving President Major Hayes was the guy in charge of MI1B, and his team affectionately put together this book, which again was a series of anecdotes and cartoons and what have you of the folks. So you really get under the skin of the individuals here, get that individual story.
And Dilly's bath.
And Dilly's bath, indeed. Yeah, I won't spoil the fun, but yes, there's a bath that appears in the exhibition that picks a Dilly Knox story. And for those people who know Dilly Knox will probably know what we're talking about, but those who come and see, you know, Dilly's bath and understand the story around it.
So, turning really personally for you, because you've had a fascination in World War One, especially, haven't you, for years?
Indeed. I mean, my personal interest in history is really the industrialisation of warfare, so from the American Civil War through to the end of the First World War. Really. So it was great to be able to sort of help steer this exhibition out, having been on the battlefields of the First World War, taking people around for many years. It's nice to look at another one of the different stories. Mm. Yeah, this is a story that, as I said at the sort of the opening with the friends this evening, it's a story that nobody else is really telling. There's a very small part about the Zimmerman telegram, I think, in the Imperial War Museum's great new First World War galleries.
Which was so important.
Absolutely. But we're telling a piece that nobody else seems to be telling, which is great. So it provides those people with an interest in the First World War, some are different, to come on those World War One trail around the countryside and come and see a different story. And it's perhaps worth putting at this point, of course, you know, like all these exhibitions, they don't come cheap and they have to be funded. And it's worth recognising that the funders of this exhibition also have a lineage in this business. Ultra Electronics and BAE both trace themselves back to companies who were involved in this business in the First World War, so it's great for them that they can support us, without which it wouldn't happen, but also, you know, connect their modern existence with their predecessors.
It's that great link back to Marconi.
Absolutely,
it?
Yeah, the Marconi thing is at the heart of the World War One radio story.
On Sunday, the 21st of June, the writer, historian and TV producer Taylor Downing will give a talk on his book Secret Warriors, Key Scientists, Codebreakers and Propagandists of the Great War, as part of the Bletchley Park Presents lecture series. He examines the codebreaking blunders of World War I, how Winston Churchill learned from them and went on to protect the Bletchley Park operation in World War II by wrapping it in ultra-secrecy. Taylor will also consider how wartime research paved the way for some of the 20th century's biggest scientific leaps. The World War I theme in the Bletchley Park Presents lecture series has all been part of a build-up to the opening of the major new exhibition in the Block C Visitor Centre. You can read exclusive interviews and go behind the scenes of the road to Bletchley Park in the Bletchley Park magazine by joining the Friends scheme. There are lots of other benefits of membership too. See the website for details. Join us on Saturday the 18th of July for a day of vintage glamour at the 1940s boutique. Sarah Dunn of Sarah's Do Wop Doos leads a full day workshop on the hair, makeup and style of World War II. Women had to make do with very little under severe austerity and rationing, and they creatively rose to the challenge. The day includes admission to Bletchley Park and lunch. Tickets are on sale now in the Bletchley Park shop, and there are more dates throughout the year. More on that shortly. In the meantime, go to bletchleypark.org.uk for more details on upcoming events. And don't forget, special activities for children will be laid on every day of the summer holidays at Bletchley Park. Bright Sparks at Bletchley Park gives the whole family the chance to explore codebreaking, World War II and e-safety. There are different activities each day, including craft and spy workshops for all age groups, children's guided tours, trails, quizzes and collections they can touch, which is rare. They won't even know they're learning. They'll think they're just having fun. It's all laid on at no extra cost every day throughout the school holidays. The 1940s boutique opens its doors again on Saturday the 18th of July for a day of vintage glamour. At the first boutique last year, I met a woman who'd come with her two daughters. Chatting to them, it emerged they'd been inspired to come by her mother, who worked at Bletchley Park during the war. She'd died some 15 years ago, but she had a sad story, which, although it was light on detail, has become family legend. Before meeting them, I spoke to Sarah Dunn of Sarah's Doo-Wop Doos, who is running the day, and her model for the day, MK News reporter Jessica Duncan. Meanwhile, Bletchley Park researcher Kerry Howard met some of the women who'd signed up for a very stylish day out.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. No, no, no. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Till I come marching home.
So how do you feel it's going so far?
As long as everyone's happy, I'm happy. Yeah.
I really like what you said. You should feel great. You should feel like you can take on the world.
Yeah.
So do you feel like you can take on the world?
Yes, no, definitely.
Have you ever seen yourself look anything like you do?
I've never seen myself look this glamorous, so I'm absolutely in awe of what she's just done in so little time as well. I think she's incredible. And I think all of these girls are really going to enjoy the transformation that they're all about to go through with her help.
It's right, it is a transformation. I think that's the key word, that we have sleek hair, you know, I was saying earlier about the contouring, and even the 40s makeup is so, so different, and I think people will see themselves completely differently. But hopefully feminine, pretty, but, you know, it's such a great look, and the silhouette's just stunning, so I really want people to feel completely transformed. I love that, yeah. It's an absolute transformation.
And we could easily fall into the trap of thinking that this is all about people as young and fresh as Jess here, but it applies to all ages, isn't it?
The great thing is that it suits all ages, you know. Everybody looks good in this look. I mean, again, the look from the 40s was born out of austerity and not having very much, and women were able to do so much with so little. So it's about just trying things out. If you don't like it one way, change it up. The pattern, the setting pattern that I've taught today, people will be able to go home and wear it in a million different ways, and that's the fun of it. You find out what works for you, and I'm on hand to give kind of one-to-one advice about that as well. So what works for one person is not going to work for the person sat next to them, so I'll go in there and kind of make sure that they get them away with a look that they're happy with as well, which is nice. It can be very much tailored to each person, so the nice thing is that I've got time now to kind of on with people. You know, people's hair types different, people wear their makeup differently, people might like certain parts of the look and not the other, so it's about tailoring this to suit you, keeping it authentic and 40s, but also going away with something that you're really happy with that makes you feel good. You should leave here feeling fantastic. Introduce yourself.
Well, I'm Faye McKinney, and this is Leslie Flint, my sister.
And what brought you here today?
Well, it's actually a birthday present to ourselves. I'd done a headscarf day with Sarah, and I'd planned on booking a half day with her for the two of us. And then this came up. I saw this online and thought that'd be a fabulous, nice day out for us both, and actually looking at the makeup side as well.
So you're both interested in 1940s, and you go to some vintage festivals?
The whole style, the music. We run a singing group and we do quite a bit of 1940s in that as well.
And then, so we've been to events like Twin Woods, and we have an older sister who lives up north, and she's very much into it as well. But we're always on the lookout for sort of more vintage wear and more vintage events around this area as well. And so we've, up till now, we've been kind of cobbling together, been looking at YouTube, really, about how to do the hair and how to do the makeup. And obviously Sarah seems to be the leading expert in the Bedfordshire area. So we thought we would come to the horse's mouth and find out exactly how to adapt the 40s style to modern day cuts, because my older sister's got shorter hair. I've got sort of medium length hair with a fringe, and my obviously younger sister's got longer hair with a short fringe. So we wanted to figure out how to incorporate the fringe specifically, and also shorter hair in 1940s styles.
And what is it about the 1940s style that resonates with you?
I think with us, we always like to make an effort. We do like to dress up as well. And that idea of dressing up has gone out in modern times. People don't tend to dress up. They tend to sort of dress down if they're going either for a restaurant or wherever. And so it's nice to be able to actually just make a real effort. And the care of detail, whether it's the hair and it's the makeup,
it flatters women's figures. And so it is the whole silhouette, the way it kind of looks.
And it's great for all figures. So if you look at a good 1940s cut, whether it's a pencil skirt and a jacket, that looks fabulous on someone who's size 16, size 18, or someone who's size 10. We've got a lot of Vivian Holloway clothes, which again is 50s and 40s. And in our dance little section of the singing group, we all have Vivian Holloway dresses, and ranging from the size 18 to the size 10, all the women look fabulous in it because of the way it's cut.
We haven't done the hair yet, but how would you rate the day? Do you think it's sort of worth the time and the effort to make your way to come?
It is. Sarah is incredibly knowledgeable and amazing. She never dries up once. She keeps the banter going forever, even when there's quiet bits. And there wasn't many people that had to ask any questions because she was just a wealth of knowledge of information.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, she covered it all, didn't she, in some useful, like, little facts that you would never have known.
Well, it's funny when she was talking about her lip liner, saying that she did it on her hand first to warm it up, and I was thinking, well, I do that, but I never knew why I did it, you know. So there's lots of little tips of just where she applies makeup and just, you know, does the hair, and that it has made the world's difference.
Well, I'd like to say thank you for your time and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you very much.
You like my style, why don't you make me know it? You like my walk, you like my talk, well, there's only one way to show it. If you want to shake my hand, like they do it in Harlem, stick your hand right out and shout, give me some skin. My friend, step right up and take your stand. You don't have to be timid, stick your hand right.
My name is Suzanne Gall. I'm a beauty therapist and tutor at Central Bedfordshire College. I've come to this 1940s boutique with my colleagues as a part of our CPD programme, so that we have to teach our students about different eras of makeup and hairstyles, and so we just thought this was a really good way.
All there's worse ways of career development.
Yes, this is a wonderful way. We get to enjoy ourselves. My colleagues also have been watching the programme on the TV.
The Bletchley Circle. Yes,
that's right. And so it was sort of all linked together. And so we had a look online, and then we saw this event was happening. So we all jumped at the chance. We have to show the students that if they're on just a hairdressing course, that there are other progression routes. So if you wanted to go into film and TV, theatre, so there's different areas. And so you'd have to be more authentic in your styles. So you do teach about history.
What have you found about today? Have you come across some interesting facts that you didn't know?
It was just probably, you know, learning about ingredients and things, your beetroot and the starch, and you know, how we'd be horrified about not being able to wash our hair every day. It's just those sorts of things, really, more than anything else. And you know, how you'd gone 3 or 4 days worth of hairstyle, whereas we would just brush it out the next day. You know, one day at the hairdresser and we don't blink an eye, whereas it was a big thing to go to the hairdresser then. So, yeah,
it's
just reinforced about how frugal they had to be, really, I think. Or an instant society, whereas in
absolutely,
those days they
yes.
weren't. So, yeah, it's the difference is how, you know, they've had to plan for their hairstyle, whereas you just go home, wash your hair and do it sort of thing for the night out. So that's the difference, I think, really.
We don't wear hats now, and yet it just
no.
looks absolutely
and
wonderful.
Also, I've put this hat on, and you'd think, oh, it's so tiny, it's going to fall off. But actually, it feels, like, really well secured. And you think, you made you wonder how they managed to keep these tiny little things perched on the side of their head. But actually, I don't think I'd lose it in a gale.
Sarah did a really good job of illustrating the historical facts around
that's right,
it as well.
Yes.
And the austerity on how ingenious women had to be.
That's
then.
Right, yes.
Well, I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Well, we've had a wonderful time so far. Thank you.
Step right on.
Once more.
Shake my hand. Like they do it in Harlem today.
How do they do it?
Just stick your hands up, let out with a shout. Give me some skin, my friend. If you want to shake my hand, like they do it in Harlem, stick your hand out. Give me some skin.
often say you never know who you'll bump into at Bletchley Park, and this really is a case in point. At that first 1940s boutique, a woman had been treated to the day by her two daughters, and they had a very personal reason for wanting to visit Bletchley Park.
So tell me about your mother. What did you know about what she'd done?
Well, that she worked in London. She says she worked underground a lot because of the bombing. She was in the ATS, and we believe she was a cipher operator. Whether or not she was involved in codes, I have no idea. But she was brilliant at maths. Intimidatingly so, from my point of view. I don't know what else, really.
And it was just a passing mention, wasn't it, from your father that pointed you towards Bletchley?
Yes, he believed that she may have been in Bletchley. We're not sure. I mean, and so we need to find out a bit more, really.
Did that spark your interest in coming here?
Oh, yes, and the film that's been done about Enigma and the Bletchley Circle, and, I mean, it's all very fascinating. My two daughters, Rebecca and Victoria, they have a boy and a girl each, and of course they're all studying the wars at the moment because of the anniversaries coming up. So, I mean, for their sakes, we'd like to find out more.
You do know little snippets, don't you? Tell me about the family wedding.
Rebecca knows more about that. She's older.
I went down to South Wales to speak to her sister a couple of weeks ago, and she told me that Nana had found out that her brother had been killed in Italy. Before the family knew he'd been injured, but they didn't actually know he'd died, and she had to go back to South Wales for a family wedding without being able to tell the family that he was actually dead. And they were all talking about, oh well, you know, let's hope he gets sent home, let's hope he survives, and she was just sobbing at the wedding, and they couldn't understand why, because she knew and they didn't.
Can you imagine holding on to a secret like that?
Unbelievable. I couldn't have done that.
And knowing her, what does that make you think, your memories of her?
She was a very well-respected, how would you describe her? Sort of kept herself to herself, didn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, she was very loyal to people, yes, yes. Oh, we all loved her, you know.
So it wouldn't have surprised me that she could have done that.
Yeah,
she definitely. Keep a secret, all right.
So much so that you now, it's too late and you don't know.
I know, it's so sad that we've not got her here to talk to anymore, but we'll try and find out what we can.
Find out a little bit more.
And get a lovely hairdo into the bargain today.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. This is a wonderful day.
Going out for dinner later, great. Looking all glam, won't we?
Yeah. Lovely.
Enjoy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have the Canadian Broadcasting Company to thank for the star of this episode. CBC show The Current featured a fantastic documentary about a woman who'd heard her mother's voice in a programme about a legendary war correspondent. He was interviewing her as she was being shipped home from England to Canada at the end of the war. The reason it meant so much to May Hyde to hear her mother's voice in this piece of news history is that she died when May was just 10 years old and she couldn't remember her mother's voice. That recording set May on a quest. Howard Goldenthal tells the story in this wonderful documentary.
I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, sitting in for Anna Maria Tremonti, and this is The Current.
It's beautiful. It's the greatest encryption device in history, and the Germans use it for all communications.
Everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Let me try, and we'll know for sure.
Mr. Turing, do you know how many died because of it?
I don't.
Three. While we've been having this conversation.
Well, that is a scene from The Imitation Game, a movie which tells the story of Alan Turing, the brilliant mathematician who broke the Nazi codes at a time when it looked like Hitler may win the war. Alan Turing did his code breaking at a legendary top secret establishment in England. It was called Bletchley Park. And it was at Bletchley that handful of women with the Canadian Navy, known as Wrens, worked in the shadows to help defeat the Axis. This is a story of two of those Canadian Wrens. The documentary by The Current's Howard Goldenthal is called In Search of Anne.
It is a cold, snowy day outside the Sunnybrook Veterans Residence in Toronto. I am with an Ottawa woman I have come to know only through email and phone calls. And she is here in Toronto on a quest.
Well, my name is May Hyde. And the reason we are here is because of a very curious recording made in 1945.
We were able to talk to some of the repat troops. For instance, now here's an Ottawa girl who's going home.
And that recording is a precious link to her mother.
Anne Veronica Hereford. Our mother died in 1966. My brother was 13 and I was 10 when she died.
What do you know about your mom's war service?
Very little.
May contacted me after our interview about CBC war correspondent Matthew Halton. It had brought back memories of a recording that had been in her family for decades. She thought I'd be interested. A piece of a puzzle about her mother's wartime role.
It was our father, Peter, who in perhaps the late 80s told me about our mother having been at Bletchley Park. I think the reason it came up in conversation was that there was a play about the life of Alan Turing, and my father and I were going to see it, and that was how he came to tell me that there was a connection.
And of course, that connection was to one of the greatest secret Allied operations of World War II, Bletchley Park. The legendary place in England where mathematicians and scientists worked in super secret to break the Axis communication codes. It was here that Anne Hereford worked as a lead Wren, a part of the Canadian Navy. And though her exact role is still cloaked in mystery, she was doing her part to pry loose the secrets of the Nazi and Japanese war machines.
They had signed the Official Secrecies Act, and many of these people actually kept that secret until they died. And it was pointed out to me that I was very fortunate to even know that my mother had been at Bletchley Park.
Despite the gaps in her understanding of her mother's war work, May is in awe of the fact that her mother worked in a place that has become a legend in the world of intelligence.
You know, it was a very important place in terms of the outcome of World War II. And until quite recently, I found that few people knew where or what Bletchley Park was. They'd never heard of the Enigma Code or the Alan Turing.
But now Bletchley Park has become part of the popular culture, with Hollywood discovering its irresistible true storyline of mathematical brilliance, secrecy, and wartime intrigue. But for May Hyde, movies and miniseries about Bletchley Park bring home the excruciating reality of being unable to ask her mother about her time there.
I can't watch these TV shows like Bletchley Circle, and I just find it's too painful. But perhaps this process now that we're embarking on of finding out about what she did will take away that sense of loss and mystery.
And inside the Sunnybrook Veterans Center is the woman who she hopes can clear up some of the mystery. Jean Powell was also a lead Wren who worked at Bletchley Park. Back then, she was Jean Tackerberry. Her job was to read the decoded cables and make sure they got into the right hands. And she remembers Anne Hereford.
It would just be lovely to hear what she was like as a person, in addition to the actual work, which is of sort of historical significance.
Let's go see Jean. Inside Sunnybrook Veterans Center, we walk down a long hallway to Jean's room.
Hi, Mom. This is May Hyde.
Her son, Bill, introduces us.
And you look a lot like your mom.
This is what I've been told.
Yeah. Jean sits in a wheelchair.
Thank you.
Her head crowned with white hair.
Sorry, I didn't know her better. You know, I mean, we were all divided up in different
Despite
sections.
Never having met before, there is an immediate connection between the two women, the elderly Wren and the daughter of her former comrade in war.
Some shortbread.
Thank you. Yeah.
On the table are scrapbooks filled with memories of Bletchley Park and pictures of other postings where Jean and her fellow Wren served. And amid the papers is a 70-year-old poem written by an officer about the Canadian Wrens he knew. May starts to read.
Baker, who often was so prone to sing, should wait till she's alone.
That is good.
To Hereford, my very best. She stacked up nobly with the rest.
So you went to the famous Bletchley Park.
Yes.
Tell me about Bletchley Park.
Well, it was a beautiful spot. And when you were going, you could see that a little bit of a lake and there were a rowboat and everything. It was to be a disguise as a golf course. But going back to London, if you notice on the left, there was a barn painted, and so it looked like another street or another tunnel. And that was for the Germans to see and bump into it. I don't know anything with that. And I was given the job of, what did they call it?
Classifier.
And the rest of the room was with the British Wrens who had been sent back to England from the East. And they'd come over every morning and say, "Have you heard from prison camp so-and-so?" And I'd say, "No." And I asked the padre the other day, "Do you suppose God will forgive me for lying so many times about that?" Because I wouldn't tell them. I wouldn't. No, we were told, I think it just came to us naturally, that these codes were being broken, and you wouldn't tell anybody.
And finally, May would learn what her mother Anne was like at Bletchley. And she is surprised by what she hears.
She was a very private person. She hung out with the rest of the girls, you know, but I mean, she was a little bit quiet, I think.
Isn't that interesting?
Was she not quiet?
Well, my understanding is that she was an extrovert. But
then May takes out that 1945 recording, recently transferred from a 78 RPM to CD. And we listen.
"We were able to talk to some of the repat troops. For instance, now here's an Ottawa girl who's going home on the New Amsterdam. She's leading Wren Anne Hereford. Will you tell us something about your career in the Navy, Anne?"
"Well, it's been a very pleasant career so far, and I think this is about the most pleasant moment, going home."
"You've been in the Navy a long while, haven't you?"
"Yes, since December the 7th, 1942.
"And how long have you been over here?"
"Over here just since April."
"What have you been doing here?"
"Well, I'm a classifier, and that's about all I can say."
"I believe I'm not supposed to ask any more than that."
"No."
"Well, how do you feel about going home?"
"About going home?"
"That's very good."
It takes my breath away. When I first obtained the recording, I think I listened to it about 24 times. It just kept going over and over and over, and I just wanted more, 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 you know, to hear her voice, because I don't remember her voice.
And it's funny, the guy who was interviewing her said, "Well, I guess I shouldn't ask any more questions."
"Yes, yes, yes, smart fella."
"You really did play a very significant role, whether you were aware of it at the time or not." "And
well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I hope everybody appreciated it, you know."
Thanks to CBC for letting us share that documentary from The Current. Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.